case, Schwartz versus Prudential Insurance. Ms. Goldblum.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Marcy Goldblum, representing the plaintiff appellant, Alana Schwartz, in this case. This case has to do with Prudential Insurance unreasonably denying Ms. Schwartz's application for long-term disability benefits. The doctor hired by Prudential, Dr. Niebler, recognized that Ms. Schwartz, because of her multiple impairments, is unable to sit for prolonged periods of time. He also recognized that because of morning stiffness, that would be even more difficult in the morning. I think we all can take notice of the fact that a legal secretary cannot perform her job, can't sustain it, if she can't sit long enough to perform her job tasks. Bella Dama, who was the agent of Prudential, made clear that this job involves mostly sitting. All of the job tasks, typing, using a computer, all of those job tasks involve substantial sitting. Sitting in this job was a material and substantial element. Now, Prudential ultimately denied benefits because Dr. Niebler suggested that the inability to sit for prolonged periods of time could be accommodated. He suggested that she could have a comfortable chair and that prolonged sitting shouldn't have to be done. And on that basis, Prudential denied benefits. However, under any standard of review, that was unreasonable. Dr. Niebler has absolutely no vocational background, and this suggestion that, number one, a job that is primarily performed sitting could be done by someone who can't sit for prolonged periods of time makes no sense. Furthermore, the suggestion that somehow having a comfortable chair would make a difference is not found anywhere in the record. And as further proof of how unreasonable this whole suggestion is, when Sacknoff and Weaver, who were the employers, filled out a form and they were asked about accommodations, they only listed one accommodation. That accommodation was a decrease in the hours worked. There's nothing about decreasing the amount of sitting that could be done. There's nothing about how the job could be done without sitting for prolonged periods of time. And there's a reason for that. The job of legal secretary cannot be done without prolonged amounts of sitting. And this is an individual who nobody on either side of this dispute recognizes. Alana Schwartz cannot sit for prolonged periods of time. And I think if we take a common sense look at it, the treating physician in this case has also reported that Alana has problems with fatigue. Those type of non-exertional limitations were never considered. So you have this individual who not only can't she sit for prolonged periods of time, but she also is fatigued. It's throughout the record that she doesn't sleep well, and she's been on numerous medications for that. In fact, she's on a lot of medications, which were also not considered by the defendant. So you have this individual who can't sit. She's not sleeping, so her concentration isn't full. She is fatigued. And as we all know, a legal secretary, we all depend on our legal secretaries. It's not a job that you can do if you're not cognitively on force. We can just imagine an individual who hasn't slept, she's in pain, makes the mistake, faxes privileged material to opposing counsel, or makes some other mistake that the attorney just doesn't have time to catch, and you have an untenable situation. None of this was considered by the defendant by cavalierly deciding that an individual who cannot perform the major aspect of her job could somehow be accommodated. Now, Prudential argues that it was reasonable for them to suggest that she could do her job with accommodations because the definition of disability in this case includes reasonable modifications. But what's missed throughout is that the job duty that's being modified, it has to be a reasonable accommodation. It has to be a reasonable modification. And there's absolutely nothing about this suggestion that's reasonable. In addition, there's a suggestion that's made by Prudential that it was reasonable for them to deny benefits because Alana had had many of these problems for a long time before she stopped working, and that she, quote, had not evidenced a worsening of her condition. Now, in the lower court, the district court recognized that under Hawkins, a worsening of her condition wasn't necessary. However, more fundamental in this case is that there actually was a worsening of her condition. In fact, in August of 2001, there was an MRI that showed a herniated disc at the L5-S1 level that was indenting the thecal sac.
Before you go in further in terms of that, can you just speak to the standard of review? I know you said whether it's de novo or arbitrary and capricious, you know, you would win. That's your position. But, of course, Judge St. Eve did not use the de novo standard in terms of her review. And so if we were to make such a finding, it could be remanded back to her for appropriate review.
That would be a possibility, although it's also our position that if you decide simply that...
Because this whole issue of discretion and the discretion of the plan administrator really makes a big difference. But your position is it doesn't matter. Under either standard, you prevail.
Under arbitrary and capricious standard of review, if the decision is unreasonable, if it lacks a rational basis, then it still can't stand. It's our position that in this case, Prudential's decision was unreasonable. It didn't have a rational basis. But to speak on the standard of review, yeah, we do believe that a de novo standard of review applies. In the court's Diaz decision, it made clear that the satisfactory to Prudential language does not confer discretion. So we're left with
the language here is identical to the language in Diaz and Prudential, isn't it?
It wasn't, in fact. The language that in this that's
the
found in the
that
plan
we, that we said it does not confer this unbridled discretion on Prudential is the same here in
yes.
this plan as it was in Diaz.
Yes, absolutely.
And Judge St. Eve did talk about a. Arbitrary and capricious standard in her opening her opinion and at the end, but all through it, it seems like she's just talking about reasonableness, as I read it.
Well, I think that because the case law has held that although under the arbitrary and capricious standard, the court still has to have meaningful review and it doesn't just act as a rubber stamp, that if the decision makers, if the finding is unreasonable, then it can't stand. So I think Judge St. Eve was looking at that standard of reasonableness. And it's our position that, in fact, this decision was not reasonable. But getting back to the language found in the plan is identical to the language that was in Diaz, which does not confer discretion. It does not provide enough to confer the deferential standard. Judge St. Eve also looked to the summary plan description, which doesn't... The summary plan description, when there is a conflict in this situation, the plan itself has to prevail. And there's a good policy reason for that. The plan is what sets the relationship. The plan gives if the language is there, gives deference to the insurer, to the finder of fact. But none of our courts have ever used the summary plan description to give authority, to give deference to the insurer that wasn't in the plan itself. And there have been arguments made, well, the summary plan description has been relied upon if the insured has relied upon it, but that's different. In terms of looking at the construction of contracts and insurance, if the drafter has created language such that the even on the summary plan description with which the insured relies upon, then our courts have said, fine, you can rely on that to expand it to give rights to the insured. But there has been no court that has said you can rely on what's not actually in the plan to expand the rights of the insured.
Right.
The insurer,
in other words,
rather.
Your position is the underlying contract had the, I mean, it's not there.
The underlying contract,
contract
it's not
there. Needs to trump the language of the summary plan, even if an employee relied on it.
That's correct. And I think that plaintiff appellant's reply brief at pages 1 through 5 really discusses that in great detail. But our bottom line also is that even under an arbitrary and capricious standard of review, even if this panel were looking at was Prudential's conduct, was the decision not just wrong, but was it unreasonable, there's only one conclusion you can come to, which is that, yes, this was inherently unreasonable. As I was saying, though, in terms of not just the fact that they found that this woman who can't sit for long periods of time can do a job that requires her to sit for long periods of time, in reviewing her case and in demanding that she show a worsening of her condition, which is not required under this court's Hawkins case, the Prudential also ignored all the evidence of worsening around the time that she stopped working.
But why, if Prudential relies on this independent medical from a board-certified doctor, why would that just bespeak of unreasonableness?
Well, we're not saying that that Prudential or the insurance companies can't rely on independent examiners if the ultimate opinion that's rendered makes sense, if it's reasonable, if it has a rational basis. Even in this court's Davis decision, it made clear that there has to be a rational basis for the insurer's ultimate decision, that there has to be it has to be well-reasoned. If a finding by an independent doctor, even if it were relatively short, but gave an indication of what he relied on and ultimately made sense overall, then we really wouldn't have much of an argument on that basis. But that's not what happened here. Dr. Niebler found, based on his review of the record, his independent review, that Ms. Schwartz could not sit for prolonged periods of time, that in the morning, because of stiffness, she's going to have even a more difficult period of time in terms of sitting and moving around. And then he suggests, completely out of his area of specialty, that somehow that could be accommodated in a job that nonetheless requires her to sit all the time, but there's no basis given for why he's able to make that opinion, and we submit that there is no basis, and that logically that job cannot be done by someone who can't sit for long periods of time, and that's something that all of us as attorneys are aware of. Our legal secretaries have to be able to sit long enough to get the job done, and in this instance she cannot. So if there are no other questions, I'll reserve my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Ms. Goldblum. Ms. McMahon?
May it please the Court. Thank you, Your Honor. With me today is my associate, Edna Bailey, who was primarily the author of our briefs. The outcome determinative issue on this appeal, we believe, is the standard of review. Judge Williams, I think you identified what would happen if it's not the arbitrary and capricious standard. If it is de novo, our position in our briefs, and we think supported by the case law, would be that the case be remanded so that the issue could be addressed under the de novo standard by the district court in the initial instance.
And if it went back, the record wouldn't be limited to the underlying administrative record that's before Prudential now. There could be more evidence presented.
It's subject to this court's rulings in cases like Perlman, which would show, which indicate that there would have to be a showing of good cause as to why we should go beyond the administrative record. But that would
There's
be correct.
There's
a possibility. possibility. We believe that the proper construction of the line of cases leading up to this point on an issue that this court has not yet addressed is that the arbitrary and capricious standard should apply in this instance. Here we've got a situation where the clear language which would support a finding of that level of review is contained in the summary plan description, which is a plan document that's issued to each and every employee.
But the big problem here...
Really talking about split hairs here, aren't you?
Well,
want to, in effect, get a decision here that's contrary to the recent decision.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that an attempt here should be made to reconcile the decisions. And there is a consistent and reconcilable interpretation of the whole line of cases leading up to this point, which lead to the conclusion that the arbitrary and capricious standard review should apply in this instance. And with the court's indulgence, I'd like to walk the court through our position in that regard.
Perhaps, I just don't understand how, if it's missing in the contract, the underlying document, how the summary plan can create rights that or define something that's not in the document.
Right. We dispute that it's missing from the underlying document, Your Honor. And I would start out with the court's recent decision in Scheiman, which articulates what the standard should be in determining whether the arbitrary and capricious language is contained in the plan documents. And that says, quote, a clause that not only represents the plan sponsor's decision, but also communicates the rules to the participants and beneficiaries is enforceable under ERISA. Looking at that test in isolation, I think we can all agree that the language in the SPD, if it's otherwise appropriate under rules of contract construction, meets both of those requirements. So the issue here is because that identical language is not contained in other plan documents, does that create some kind of conflict which would trump the summary plan description? The line of cases going back to Donato and Bali indicated that the language satisfactory to Prudential would have vested Prudential with discretionary authority to decide benefits. When Hershberger was decided and created the safe harbor language with specific language advising courts that to be on the safe side, advising plan administrators that to be on the safe side, this is the language you should use, the Hershberger court specifically mentioned that Donato and Bali were still good law, and that those
I don't know how they can be good law after reading Hershberger.
It says so itself in the Hershberger opinion, Your Honor, that Donato and Bali are still acknowledged as, in the section where it's discussing, there is no magic words, and we're not requiring that this language be used in all instances. And then it gives instances where the court has acknowledged that the arbitrary and capricious standard of review is supported by language such as determined by us, and then cites specifically to Donato and Bali. The Diaz case then addressed the issue and expanded Hershberger and addressed head-on Donato and Bali again. And our reading of Diaz is this, that it doesn't, it's not saying that the Seventh Circuit was wrong on Donato and Bali. What it's saying is that there's an additional requirement. There may be the as decided by Prudential language may be sufficient to vest Prudential with discretionary authority, but it's not adequate notice to the participants and beneficiaries of the plan who are entitled to know what the terms of the plan are using layman's terms and plain and ordinary language, which, incidentally, is what the requirement is for the SPD. The summary plan description is required to be put in layman's terms, the language that's contained in the plan. In taking a look at Hershberger, there's a specific reference in the opinion that the distinction of as determined by us and the close reading of the documentation does, and I think that the quote is, require sort of a lawyerly analysis. And the Diaz court said, you know, we're going to extend this and say that the individual plan and participants should not be required to engage in that lawyerly analysis. They should be allowed to get the impact of the language that's in the plan in layman's terms. And that's exactly what has occurred here. In this instance, the as determined by Prudential language is in the policy, and which is the contract that is between the employer and the company that the employee is a beneficiary of. And then the document that's given to the employee, the summary plan description, specifically articulates what the impact is of that. There is a two-pronged requirement, as mentioned in Scheinman. The clause must represent the plan sponsor's decision to vest discretion with Prudential. The policy language still has that, and that's consistent with Donato and Bali and that line of cases, and even Herzberger, to the extent that acknowledged Donato and Bali at that time, were still good law. It's just that in Diaz, an additional requirement was adopted by this court that that's not good enough notice to a layman to let them know that when you're signing on to this plan, you're allowing the insurance company to have broad discretionary authority, and that we are going to require something better than that language so that there's fair notice given to the layman. Now, there's this discussion. So from that perspective, I don't think there's an inconsistency. Another way to look at it, Your Honor, is that there's a line of cases that have said that a reasonable interpretation of the as determined by Prudential language is that it vests Prudential with discretionary authority. In fact, even in Diaz, there's a concession that it was reasonable for the district court to assume in that case that discretionary authority was vested. If that is a reasonable interpretation of that term, but the argument by the plaintiff is that an ambiguity exists, you look to the plan documents to resolve that ambiguity. And here, the document that's actually given to the individual specifically says language that's consistent with the safe harbor provision in Herzberger. So whether you look at this from the standpoint of is the summary plan description merely putting in layman terms language that is contained in the policy that vests Prudential with discretion, or is the summary plan description as part of an approach from a contract construction standpoint there to resolve what could be an alternative reasonable interpretation of that language, under either conclusion, you must conclude that discretionary authority has been vested with Prudential. I would remind the court that the policy and the summary plan description are all together in one document, consecutively numbered, with a table of contents that identifies them all as the same. As a practical matter, in this instance, the employees actually got the full package. The summary plan description specifically articulates that it is there to provide in layman's terms what the impact is of the plan provisions. So there's no question here that in this instance there is language that clearly vests Prudential with discretionary authority and is consistent with the safe harbor language in Herzberger, and that language was actually given to the employee. And that's distinguishable from, for example, the Ruttenberg case, where the language was clear that it vested discretionary authority, but it was contained in the application for the group policy. And this court held that that's not the kind of document that an employee would normally get. So it wouldn't be fair notice to an employee that there is discretionary authority. The Ruttenberg court looked at various documents to try to find if that language was elsewhere, and the documents it looked to were the certificate of insurance, the group policy, and the summary plan description. I think a reasonable interpretation of this court's finding in Ruttenberg is that those are the types of documents you need to look to decide whether or not discretionary authority has been vested. And if that language is contained in those types of documents anywhere, and it's not inconsistent with other language in the plan documents where contract rules of construction may need to apply, then you must enforce the arbitrary and capricious standard of review. This court's recent ruling in Simeon, I think, is instructive on that point. In Simeon, as this panel is aware, the issue was whether discretionary language contained in an administrative services agreement was sufficient to invoke the discretionary standard of review. That was a situation where the language that was being analyzed was not contained in a summary plan description that was valid. In that instance, there was an issue as to whether the SPD was valid, and so the court ignored the SPD. And the language was not elsewhere in a group policy. And this court held that taking the rule in this jurisdiction that what the plan documents can be a number of different documents that must be read together with an attempt to reconcile their terms, this court concluded that the discretionary standard review would apply in that instance. A logical extension of the Simeon opinion, the Scheinman opinion, Ruttenberg, Diaz, Donato, Bali, and Herzberger, is that in this instance the proper approach is which was adopted by the district court in the Willis case we cite in our brief, that it is appropriate to look at plan documents, and the SPD is of course a plan document, attempt to determine whether there's a conflict, and do you need to apply rules of contract construction, and it has fair notice been given to the plan participants. Applying that approach, the only conclusion should be that the discretionary standard of review applies here.
Mr. McMahon, what would be wrong with the approach where the main contract is either silent or, as you would have it in this case, needed to be augmented by the summary plan, to say in those cases a de novo standard should apply?
Well, I think that Your Honor, the a critical aspect of ERISA plans in general is that they're maintained and established by the employer. And in this instance, the SPD, as it says on its face, was given to the employees at the request of the employer and was a document that the employer endorsed. And the issue is, how do you give meaning to the intent of the employer in establishing the employee welfare benefit plan? Certainly, you could have that type of language in the policy, the body of the policy itself. And if that was the case, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now.
Right. Well,
but in this instance,
I don't mean to interrupt you, but shouldn't we be heading toward a day where, as to the core language, there shouldn't be any difference between the summary plan and the base contract?
Well,
in the sense that we're speaking of today.
Right. I to the extent that the SPD is intended to be a summary of a document that often contains a lot of legalese and a lot of extrinsic information that the employee would never know, and also it's required to be put in layman's terms, not lawyerly terms, as to paraphrase
but
the
Hirschberg
Report.
But see, a lot of those cases you cited, mm-hmm. it was just a matter of taking what was a lot of lawyer gobbledygook mm-hmm. and putting it in the plan.
Right.
It wasn't a situation where it didn't exist in the contract, in the way it is here, I'm concerned as well. Why aren't we on the road to making both consistent?
Well, I will say in this particular instance, Your Honor, the policy was issued prior to the Diaz decision coming down, and prior to Diaz, the case law appeared to be very clear that the as determined by Prudential language, in and of itself, without some special notice given to the employee, was sufficient to vest a company like Prudential with discretion. So for this particular case, Diaz wasn't around when it issued that initial policy. To the benefit of Prudential, it did in the summary plan description, which although the employer authorized its issuance and it was issued at its discretion, Prudential drafted, contains what does that language mean? It contains, in layman's terms, a full explanation of exactly what that means when we say, as determined by us, and that we're vested with arbitrary and capricious review authority. Now, I agree with you. You know, you won't have to deal with these types of issues anymore if the exact same language is contained in the plan as contained in the SPD. But the reality of the situation is, while we're in a transitional mode, there are companies that are out there who have been doing business, we're faced with the language that we have in each given case. If there are no further questions, I see my time is up.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McMahon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Goldblum?
Excuse me. One of the big differences between the case here and Scheinman, Simeon, is that in this case, in the page right before the summary plan description, which is found at page 00082 of the record, it clearly states in big, bold language that the summary plan description is not part of the group insurance certificate. So you have that as to begin with. And furthermore, the argument that, well, when we're in this transitional period, we can kind of assume that the summary plan description was explaining what we thought was in the policy, that doesn't pass muster. First of all, Prudential knew enough that the language in the SPD contained the adequate language if that had been in the policy. There is no reason why they couldn't have reissued a policy that had that specific language in it. Furthermore, the basis of ERISA law was to protect the individual employee, the employees. And there is legislative history that indicates that ERISA was never meant to give the worker, to give the employee, less rights than they had before ERISA. And our case law has made clear that when there is clear direction in the policy giving deference to the insurer, that then they can have an arbitrary and capricious standard of review. But when it's not in there, and when they're saying, well, it's kind of mixed up, but look at the summary plan description here, that's what we really meant, that's inadequate, particularly in this case where the summary plan description clearly states prior to it that it's not a part of the group insurance certificate. And Judge Williams, you had asked a question about remand. If the court were to find that a de novo standard of review applies here. And I think the case of Quinn that this court issued teaches us that if it seems clear that an award of benefits is manifest by the record, then there shouldn't be a remand for what is known already. And in this case, what's clear is that Prudential's own doctor found that this individual can't sit. Her job for Prudential required her to sit all the time, at least the majority of the day, and no one's disputing that she can't do that. So we're going to ask that when you review this case, you find that a de novo standard of review applies. Even if it doesn't, under an arbitrary and capricious standard of review, plaintiff appellant is entitled to judgment in her favor. Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.